From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a slim summer for butterfly, monarch butterfly, sightings around the country. That means a lost delight for children and adults. It's also a missing butterfly heads up on our ecosystem, our agriculture, maybe our climate. This hour on Point, where is the monarch butterfly? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you noticed how few monarchs are in the air, in the garden? What's going on? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Hear a little bit of kids here joyfully running around the yard, catching or trying to butterflies.
Go, go, go.
I think he likes you.
Go, go.
This summer, not so easy to find. I got a letter from the Girl Scouts of Troop 88283 in our backyard here in Brookline, Massachusetts, asking, where are the butterflies? We poked around and found people asking the same question all over the country. Let's see what we can learn in this hour. With us first today from Shawano, Wisconsin, is Karen Oberhauser, Associate Professor in the Department of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology at the University of Minnesota. Karen Oberhauser, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So is it just our Girl Scouts and our friends' observation, or do we have fewer butterflies, monarch butterflies in particular, maybe dramatically fewer this year?
Well, actually, this year we have a few more than we have for the last 2 years. Last summer were the lowest they've ever been, and the overwintering numbers in Mexico, where they all go for the winter, were as low as they've ever been. But this summer, the weather's been a little bit better, and the population seems to be rebounding a little bit. So the Girl Scouts might be seeing more this year than they saw last year, but not as many as they would have seen 5 or 10 years ago.
Remind us exactly how monarch butterflies migrate and their pattern of movement and what they require to sort of make their annual migration, pilgrimage, north and south.
Okay. Well, if we start with thinking about monarchs right now, the monarchs that are emerging in your backyards in Massachusetts and my backyards in Wisconsin and Minnesota, where I usually live,
yep.
The butterflies that are emerging now as adults will migrate south, and they'll be starting now and moving south through the kind of the eastern half of the United States. They funnel through Texas and to overwintering sites in Mexico. They get to these sites, so the same butterflies that left your backyards will arrive in Mexico in early November, and they'll stay there through most of the winter. Emerges so that just kind of hanging in the trees in Mexico and in the mountains in central Mexico. And then those very same butterflies will fly north in the spring, and they'll repopulate kind of the southern quarter of the United States from Texas and along the Gulf Coast and then a little ways north. And then those butterflies will lay eggs in the south, and their offspring will move north into their what we call their summer breeding grounds, which kind of go from North and South Dakota over to the East Coast and a little bit into Canada. And then they go through two or three summer breeding generations, and these generations only live as adults about a month until we get to this final generation that emerges in the middle of August or later, and those are the ones that migrate south.
Now, the easiest place to kind of count up what we've got, look at the volume of butterflies, is when they collect in these colonies in Mexico. It's incredible. Over time, people have just been dismayed at the valleys just stuffed with monarch butterflies. I got just a little bit of sound here in their millions, I guess, overwintering in Mexico. The sound there of all those wings flapping in Mexico. Karen Oberhauser, please stand by in Shawano, Wisconsin. With us right now as well from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Lincoln Brower, research professor of biology at Sweetbriar College. He's been studying monarch butterflies for over 60 years. His research focuses on the overwintering, migration, conservation biology of the monarch butterfly. Lincoln Brower, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm looking at a headline here from January of this year, National Geographic, saying, migrating monarch butterflies in grave danger, numbers at new lows. What's happening, Professor Brower?
Well, a lot of things are happening, but what has happened in the last decade is just tragic, and it's been the evolution and use of enormous numbers of herbicides that are killing off the larval food plant of the monarch butterfly over hundreds of square miles of the habitat in our corn belt and soybean belt. And so these crops have been genetically engineered to be resistant to high-powered herbicides like Roundup. And in the spring or during the summer, they spray these fields, and it kills all the milkweeds. It kills all the nectar sources. It kills – I was just out in Konza Prairie in Kansas two weeks ago surveying the situation. And we were looking between the rows of corn and the rows of soybeans, and there's absolutely not a weed to be seen in sight, sometimes for literally miles as you look across these great plains of huge crops that are so industrialized now.
And those weeds, milkweed in particular, are the food that monarchs need to make their passage.
Absolutely. They, over the course of the summer and three or four generations, they build their numbers up by laying their eggs on milkweeds, and the caterpillars feed on the leaves of the milkweed plants.
I grew up in exactly those fields of corn and soybeans and more in just that part of the country in the Midwest, and I remember plenty of milkweed around. I mean, the fence rows were full of that. You'd see them out in the soybeans. Of course, they didn't have Roundup Ready GMO genetically modified crops in those days. We would go out and cut out what we could by hand with hoe or machete. And the ditches along the road were full of milkweed as well. It's kind of incredible to think that that could all be somehow tidied up and wiped out, that food supply.
Well, it has been wiped out on a scale that people just don't understand the scale of it. But I think it's a much bigger problem than just the monarch butterfly, because basically what we're doing is sterilizing our landscape and killing all the wildflowers, all the native plants, and everything that's associated in the food chains that are associated with those plants. So as I see it, the monarch is a canary in the coal mine telling us that things are getting dangerous, and it's going to eventually impact us in ways that we can't even anticipate at this point.
We'll look at the big picture there. Karen Oberhauser, how would you describe the hit that monarch butterflies have taken as a result of this change in our landscape, the sterilization, as Lincoln Brower says, of our landscape, Professor Oberhauser?
Well, I think that we can certainly, by counting the area occupied in Mexico, we know that the population has declined a lot. Monarch populations, like almost all insect populations, have natural fluctuations. They go up and down. So it actually takes quite a few years of data to see a statistically significant and biologically significant downward or upward trend.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have enough data that we know there is a significant downward trend in the numbers. If we look, there are a lot of different ways to look at that, but if we look at the very highest numbers to what we're having right now, we've lost about 90% of the population. If we look at average numbers, we've lost about 70 or 80%. So any way we look at it, the monarchs have taken a very big hit. And I think we need to think about, we've had the modification of all of the agricultural fields, which is due to the increased use of herbicides that's allowed by genetically modified crops. But we're also making some decisions as a society that are leading not to that we would call habitat modification. It's still agricultural, but it's changed from the point of view of monarchs. But we're also losing habitat. So, for example, in this country, we have the very important Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP program, which compensates farmers for not planting crops on fields that have conservation significance.
Right.
And the push for ethanol from corn and other crops has meant that we've actually lost 30% of our CRP land from 2007 to 2014. And that's a decline of 11.2 million acres of CRP land in the United States. And most of that CRP land was in the Midwestern states. So the Midwestern United States is where most of those monarchs in Mexico come from.
Lincoln Brower, you said, I think, that monarchs could go the way of passenger pigeons. Do you mean that literally, extinction?
Well, I'm concerned that that is what we're actually witnessing, and I hope I'm wrong. That would be wonderful to be wrong on that issue. But as Karen is pointing out, the loss of cropland that was put into this reserve program, converting it back into cornfields, it's just a continual nibbling away at what little natural habitat there is left for these monarchs. And I think something major needs to be done in terms of policy and agriculture. We need to convince the farmers and the people of this country that we have to have areas for wildlife to occur where they're not completely controlled by these industrialized chemicals. And if you look at the what's coming up, the number of new chemicals that are even more toxic than the ones that are there now, it's a very frightening picture of the future for biodiversity.
Lincoln Brower, please stand by at Sweetbriar College. Karen Oberhauser at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about butterflies, monarch butterflies in trouble, and why we are looking at the smallest monarch migration ever recorded. Going down to Mexico, Lucas Miller singing behind us about butterflies, but the numbers have been tiny lately. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm gonna fly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about butterflies, monarch butterflies in trouble, and why we are looking at the smallest monarch migration ever recorded. We'll talk later in this hour about some species, unexpected species that are now interbreeding as climate change changes their habitat, their terrain, creating new hybrids that we may never have seen before. But first, to butterflies, Lincoln Brower is with us, research professor of biology at Sweetbriar College, joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. He knows monarch butterflies inside and out, spent a lot of time looking at their overwintering habitat in Mexico, and he's looking at the big ecosystem picture here in the United States. Karen Oberhau joins us. She's in Shawano, Wisconsin today, but she's an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, also knows monarch butterflies inside and out. Lincoln Brower, Karen, I wanted to ask you, I mean, here we've got people, here's one of my colleagues, Kurt Nickish, who tweeted over the weekend, went hiking through fields of milkweed. This was in western Massachusetts this weekend, and didn't see a single monarch caterpillar. Shocking, but then here's Kimmeth writing to us, seen plenty of monarchs, hasn't changed what she's seen in her neck of the woods. Karen, what about it? Does it depend where you are, or how do you think about people's different experience of whether there's a shortage or not?
Well, it really does depend where you are, and we see fluctuations. So I direct a program called the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project out of the University of Minnesota, where people all over the United States and Canada are going out into the fields like the ones your colleague and Kim described, and actually looking at they record the number of milkweed plants that they look at, and they count the number of monarch eggs and caterpillars that they see. So we've been doing this project for 17 years now, and some years people in the northeastern United States see higher populations than people in the midwestern United States, and sometimes it's the reverse. This year, I'm not sure where Kimmeth, who wrote in, is mm-hmm. from, but it sounds like she might be in the Midwest, where numbers are higher this year than they were for the last couple years. So we're hoping that the population is rebounding. We're having a perfect summer here for monarchs. It's not too hot, which is stressful to them, and this is why we are concerned about increasing temperatures under climate change regimes. But it's not been too hot. We've had enough rain. It was a little dry in July, but now we're getting some rain in August, so the milkweed is in fairly good condition. So we're hoping that the population rebounds a little bit this year. We know it won't get back to norm, to average, because we've just started too low. So it really does depend on where people are.
Here's Julia writing to us, says, I haven't seen any monarchs here in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I've planted a butterfly-friendly flower bed in her front yard. Hope it helps. Lincoln Brower, the statistics I've been reading out of Mexico are kind of shocking. You help us understand these, but I'm reading here that at one time you would have 40-plus solid acres, millions and millions and millions of monarch butterflies just carpeting the forest there in the Central Mountains orange, and that this last winter they had one plus acres rather than 40 plus covered. Could that be right?
Well, I think it was actually one plus hectares, but it's still pretty small, and it's the smallest it's ever been. And another aspect of that is that back in the good old days of 10 years ago, if you can consider that old, there were about at least 12 different overwintering sites on the mountains. And this year, 7 of those disappeared completely. There were no butterflies found in them at all. And there was only one colony that had about 1.5 hectares of butterflies. So that it's not only the total number that is down, but the sites where they go are emptying out. And if you get bad weather hitting one area, it could wipe the winter population out. So the monarchs are being onslaughted from several different angles.
Can you describe what it was like to walk through those vast areas absolutely covered in monarch butterflies?
The first time I saw them in Mexico was in February 1977, and we were walking down through this beautiful green forest of fir trees, and suddenly the color of the forest changed to gray. It was an overcast day, and the butterflies were not active. And I realized, my God, I'm looking at a wall of monarch butterflies that goes as far to the left and as far to the right as I can see. It was just an unbelievable experience.
And when the sun comes out, what does it look like?
They burst and go into flight, and there'll be millions of butterflies flying around, and that soundtrack that you had early on is an example. One of the things that's really interesting is that the butterflies, when their sun hits them, they open their wings, and they will fly. And if there's a cloud that comes over the colony, they think, quote, that they're away from the colony so that they have to fly back to the colony, but they're already in the colony. And the result is that millions of monarchs fly up into the air, and that's when you get that beautiful susurrant sound that you played earlier.
Let's hear that again. It's just amazing now that you've painted the picture of it, all the butterflies. Kind of incredible that could just be wings. But from great areas covered in butterflies, we've come down to just a little over 1 hectare, we're told, in this last winter. Mike in Johnson, Vermont. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. My question is up here in northern Vermont, we haven't seen a monarch butterfly up here since Tropical Storm / Hurricane Irene came through in 2011.
Yep.
We've got plenty of milkweed. And I wonder if the population drop has been damaged by that and possibly Superstorm Sandy a couple of years ago as well.
So what are you thinking, Mike? You're not buying the herbicide, pesticide explanation, or maybe it's more than that, or
not
what?
Entirely. No, I'm not. I'm not buying that entirely because the population, the monarch population has survived that for many, many decades, and even through when we were having the drastic stuff during the 60s of the DDT poisoning that we just did on a regular basis.
Yeah, Mike, stand by. Lincoln Braha, what do you say to Farmer Mike in Vermont?
Well, the whole Northeast has been deficient in monarchs this summer, including here in Virginia where I live, and the reports are pretty uniform that absent are very few butterflies. But I think the explanation is that the butterflies move from Texas up into the Midwest where they breed, and then that next generation is the one that gets into the eastern states. And because there's relatively few successfully breeding in the Midwest, it means not very many are getting to the east. So that I think really it is in fact supporting the herbicide hypothesis.
And what about Mike's view that we had a worse record on pesticide herbicide use years ago? We've cleaned up our act.
Well, I think if you compare the number of acres that are involved now and then, that they're not comparable at all. Now it's just massive, massive acreage, tens of thousands of acres that have been wiped out with the milkweed plants.
I have to say, as a boy growing up, there was milkweed all over the place on corn and bean farms. We had corn and beans and soybeans, of course, alfalfa, oats. But in all the fence rows, there was a ton. So no shortage of monarch food in those days or places for them to come with their larvae.
Right.
A decade.
I think one thing that is interesting that Mike did bring up, certainly habitat loss and habitat modification are huge causes of the decline in monarch numbers, but Mike did bring up a very interesting point about the climate, and I think that there is quite a lot of research being done right now on monarchs and many other butterflies on the potential impacts of climate change.
How might that work, Karen?
So we certainly, warming can have an effect. We often think of climate change as just getting warmer temperatures, and so I've done some research, and others have, on the potential impacts of warmer temperatures and climate change in the wintering grounds and in the breeding grounds. But also, one thing that we predict, that climate change models predict, is increasing frequencies of extreme weather events. So these can take place in the overwintering sites. We could be seeing a higher frequency of storms in the overwintering sites, or drought, or hurricanes. So there are a lot of extreme weather events that can be very hard on organisms, and especially if they occur more frequently than they used to occur and don't give the populations time to rebound. So I think that what we need to think about is, because there are lots and lots of things affecting monarch numbers, that we need to do all we can to make sure they have as much habitat as possible. And there are a lot of things that people can do. It sounds like Mike is doing exactly the right thing. He has milkweed available. So even though you're not seeing monarchs right now, Mike, and other callers, having that habitat available for them when they do get there in summers that there are a lot of monarchs in the Northeast, we need to have the habitat available and ready for them. So anything that people can do to increase habitat, either on their own land or land that they can convince other people to create monarch habitat, plant milkweed plants, plant the nectar plants that the monarchs need, the adult monarchs need, that would be available all over the summer. That's what they need to have ready and waiting for them.
We'll look at what people could do. Lincoln Brower, what about the relative weight of you go first to GMOs and herbicides and habitat. Karen also raises climate effects. What about the relative weight of those in the recent sharp decline of monarch butterflies?
Well, I think it's theoretically possible that the climate change that is occurring may be affecting the monarchs, but it's awfully hard to know that for sure, and it's going to take a long-term study. Could I add another mitigation factor people might get involved in? Well, when I was at Kansas Prairie a couple of weeks ago with my colleague Ernest Williams from Hamilton College, one of the things we observed were wild milkweeds of 9 different species growing along the edges of the highways.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of the areas, the highways were beautiful wildflower gardens that are naturally there. In other areas, they'd been mowed or sprayed, and there was nothing there. So that if we could get the highway departments all over this country to protect 30 or 40 feet of roadside verge and let it be natural wildflowers and milkweeds, it would bring back a lot of the butterflies, I think.
We've got Iowa Prairie Man tweeting to us here on Twitter. Says, still upset over all the excellent milkweed mowed down along Iowa's roads in the past month. Another nail in the coffin of monarchs in Iowa. Says, an answer here might be change Department of Transportation policy that sees 14-inch tall milkweed in road median as a serious safety issue. Most states, Department of Transportation, he says, view anything that's not grass as weeds. He says he thinks many of the transportation roadside managers are ignorant of the decline of the monarch and importance of milkweed. It would sound to me, Karen, that if you could let some of that roadside median within bounds of safety, but let's have a care here, that would create rivers of milkweed and other sources of food for monarchs and other butterflies all over.
Yep, that's very true, and it's a very important mitigation factor. We're actually working right now on using data from the Monarch Larva Monitoring Project through the Monarch Joint Venture, which is a collaboration of many groups interested in monarch conservation, to develop a recommended time for mowing, because we know with monitoring data when monarchs move into different latitudes in the United States. So we can say these are times that it would be safe to mow, and these are times that when you go through and mow those milkweeds down, you're going to be just killing lots and lots of monarch eggs and caterpillars. So while we realize that roadsides need to be managed for safety, they can be managed much more wisely that would promote both safety and biodiversity. So we're coming up with recommended times for road crews in states throughout the U.S. to mow.
Sounds like a race with the numbers, though. Stand by, Karen and Lincoln. Rick McCullough joins us right now from Hazleton, Pennsylvania, president of Butterfly Rescue International, former president of the International Butterfly Breeders Association. Rick McCullough, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You pay a lot of attention to this. What do you see in monarch populations going on?
Not just in monarchs, but all populations are suffering. And Karen was just speaking about roadsides, and there is a wonderful study done by the University of Minnesota in regard to road salt and its effect on milkweed and butterflies, where sodium is important to the development of butterflies. Too much of it is naturally going to be toxic, and that might have been a problem up in Vermont. We had, it seemed like, never-ending snowstorms in the Northeast this winter, an excess of road salt, and that could have affected them in a negative way.
Rick, let me ask you, I mean, you're in the thick of this. We love to think of summer as a time when, I mean, from childhood, we all have, I think, memories of just being surrounded by butterflies, or lots of butterflies in the garden or around. Could we picture a time where that's just no longer part of our lives, our world?
I'm afraid to say we may, because urban sprawl is a big problem, especially on the East Coast.
Taking away habitat.
And taking away habitat, where the population in the U.S. only increased by 75% since 1955. Urban populations have increased by 300%. And along with that, you have lawns, and they use horrible chemicals. And another thing I see affecting a lot of them are the neonicotinoids, the new insecticides out. And they're using them in farmlands and in municipalities. I know I had several fields close by where friends of mine from around the world would come, and I would take them out to these farmlands. And it was acres and acres, maybe a mile on each side of milkweed. And we could tag hundreds of butterflies in an afternoon. And now we go there, and it's only genetically modified corn and cabbages, and you can't even find a simple cabbage white butterfly anymore. And I believe it's because of the neonicotinoids.
The sterilization of our rural landscape, Lincoln Brower calls it. Does that ring true to you, Rick?
Oh, by all means. And it uses urban sprawl. It increases air pollution. It uses up all our water. It pollutes the water. And it's, you know, what I found in raising butterflies for so many decades, no matter how hungry a caterpillar gets, it just will not eat macadam, concrete, or steel.
No.
And the more meadows we dig up and the more shopping centers and strip malls we plant, the less butterflies we'll have. And that includes all species.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about butterflies, monarch butterflies, in trouble. In a moment, we'll talk about how climate change appears to be sending some species into cross-species kind of hybridization, grizzlies and polar bears and you name it, getting together to deal with changing climate circumstances in their habitat. Karen Oberhauser of the University of Minnesota is with us. Lincoln Brower of Sweetbriar College. Rick McCullough of Butterfly Rescue International is here from Hazleton, Pennsylvania. Jay is calling from Fayetteville, Arkansas. Jay, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you see?
I'm a rural trash man, so I'm out here in the boonies all day long.
Yeah.
In the cornfields and everything.
Sure.
And yeah, the milkweed is down, but it's not like your the one guy said that it's all the butterflies. I mean, even the little blue ones and white ones you see on the sides of the mud puddles aren't even there. But at the same time, there's an insane amount of grasshoppers everywhere. I mean, I have to get them out of my truck every day before I quit work, or I'm going to have a whole bunch of dead grasshoppers.
Rake them out of the truck, but no butterflies to be found this summer, yeah. Or very few in Arkansas. Jay, I appreciate your call. We know populations rise and fall, but it's startling, Rick McCullough, to be talking about such deep threats to butterfly populations. What do we lose if we lose butterflies, Rick? It's not like exactly like bees that we absolutely need to pollinate crops, and yet butterflies, they're such a rich part of our environment. What do we lose if we lose them?
Well, I would have to say butterflies are second to bees in their pollinating abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very important on the food chain. I mean, you take out one food item, and the pyramid's going to collapse. Birds, reptiles, rodents, everything eats butterflies. And unfortunately, in many countries, even people do. From what I read, I will not try it myself. But you just can't take one of those links, or the whole food pyramid's going to collapse.
I mean, not
all the other species that depend on them.
Not to mention what we imagine as different ways in which children come to feel a deserved wonderment at nature. Butterflies pretty big in that, or at least they have been. Betty in Toronto, Canada. Betty, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love your show very much.
Thank you.
I go to Halliburton every year first 2 weeks of August, and that's considered Northern Ontario.
Okay.
And about 2011, 2012, there was an explosion of monarchs. Like, you could see them, unfortunately, killed on the road. I guess I've heard today on your show they go for the salt. This year I saw one killed on the road, and that's the only monarch I saw. It held through all the insect classes. There were very few moths at night. I got great photos last year of them against the windows and the light. This year, like one moth, six moths, hardly any. Dragonflies, they were landing on my arms on the dock, on the deck last year. This year, nothing. Down by the dock, there were three or four. It's just really frightening, and I wonder if it isn't too late. I remember as a kid walking in clean water up to my knees with tadpoles, fireflies. You don't see fireflies anymore. I just really wonder if it's not too late, even if we made a concerted effort for all of this.
Let us pick it up, Betty, and I appreciate your call. Karen Oberhauser, let me come to you. I mean, people, I hear a difference in the way you and Lincoln look at this, perhaps. You know, we've got listeners who are really worried about the whole system here. Christos writes, so it says, nature's beauty is just another casualty to late-stage capitalism and the death spiral of the planet that is an actual business plan. Lincoln says GMOs may put butterflies and more on the path of passenger pigeons. You spoke of a kind of a regular ebb and flow. Which do you think we're seeing here, Karen?
Well, I said there was a regular ebb and flow, but there is a downward trend. But I do want to say that I'm a conservation biologist, and at its essence, conservation biology is the science of hope. I think that we're all in this field because we have hope, and it's sad for me to hear Betty say that she wonders if it's too late. I think if we think it's too late, then we stop trying to help. So I think that we need to be hopeful, and the nice thing about butterflies is that unlike a lot of organisms that we as humans are trying to preserve, butterflies can do pretty well in somebody's yard, you know, in a suburban yard or even a park in the middle of a city.
But they have to get there, if I may say. Pat writes to us on our website, we have a surplus of milkweed in a chemical-free 2-acre yard, and I haven't seen a monarch caterpillar in 8 years.
Right. So we do need to increase. It's not just enough to do it in people's yards, and we need to do it on the roadsides and in right-of-ways and in prairie strips, in agricultural land, but they can survive in parks and yards.
Good.
So I think if we all make a concerted effort to add habitat, to increase the amount of milkweed and nectar plants and food sources, it's not just monarchs, as Rick was saying, it's all butterflies. So what people can do can really make a difference. I firmly believe that. So.
Lincoln Brower, what about, can we have hope and industrial agriculture as practiced?
I think we need to control it and get the companies to work with us and work together, and I am hopeful that we can do that. Could I give a little math problem for your audience?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
There are about 3.5 million miles of roadsides in the United States, of roads in the east of the Rockies.
Yeah.
And if you figure there's 30 feet on each side of the road, which could be habitat, have everybody calculate how many acres that is, and then figure that maybe 5 butterflies can be produced on average from each acre. How many millions of butterflies would that be?
That would be just fine, I would say, if we could pull that off.
I think it would be great.
Do you think it – well, I mean, that means – that says we could have industrial agriculture and butterflies if we turn the roadways into butterfly gardens, the medians.
Well, it'll help. It certainly will help. But I think the farmers have
to – yep. And prairie strips, I mean – farmers are interested in controlling erosion, and there are a lot of ground covers that farmers plant, and those ground covers could be just prairie strips. So, you know, I think that we need to do what we can on the habitat that's available. And I would agree that it would be great if industrial agriculture changes, but that's probably not going to happen soon enough. So we need to do what we can to hold it over until there are changes.
Gardeners, farmers, and highway departments, you can bail us out here, bail the butterflies out, it sounds to me, with a concerted effort. Rick McCullough, do you think there's time? Is there the determination to do it?
Well, we got to try. We just can't give up. But as Karen was saying, what we need to do is to educate the public, and we need to create biological bridges. Sure, you might have a perfect butterfly garden and not a single butterfly, because they just can't find you. So we need these biological bridges to direct them to the different gardens and the different areas where they could prosper. But one thing I'd like to say to Betty in Ontario and our caller from Vermont,
mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting to know that because of the climate change, their area is probably warmer. And I would like to see if there was an increase in mosquito spraying in their area. Because the application of the mosquito spray will cause death in a lot of non-targeted insects as well.
Lots to look at here. Our ecosystem really matters for us, for butterflies, for the whole food chain, and we hear it in this hour. I want to again thank Girl Scout Troop 88283 of Brookline, Massachusetts, for putting this on my desk. And I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Rick McCullough at Butterfly Rescue International in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Karen Oberhauser at the University of Minnesota. Thank you, Professor Oberhauser.
Thanks, and it was great to be on with Lincoln and Rick, too.
And Lincoln Brower at Sweetbriar College. Thanks so much, Lincoln.
Thanks, Tom. It was great.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. In a moment, stand by. We're going to look at hybrid species emerging as a result of a changing climate. This is On Point. As the climate changes, animals move. Species that once lived far apart are pushed closer together. The result can be hybrid versions of well-known animals, coyotes and wolves, creating the coywolf. Polar and grizzly bears become the pizzly bear. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Moises Velasquez-Manoff, author of the New York Times article, Should You Fear the Pizzly Bear? Moises, thanks very much for being with us. What's going on out there in the woods?
Hi, thanks for having me. Well, there are several things going on. One is, as you mentioned, that animals are adjusting to the changing temperatures and moving north or moving towards the poles. In the southern hemisphere, they're possibly moving south as well. And they basically bump into their relatives that are at higher latitudes, and they can interbreed. And one of the examples I mentioned in the piece are these flying squirrels that the American version has pushed a few hundred miles north into Canada, and it has encountered its boreal cousins. So these are more northerly versions of flying squirrels. And they're adapted to slightly different foods and slightly different environments. But what's happened is that the trees are changing, and the cold snaps in the winter are declining a little bit, with the exception of this past winter, allowing the southern versions to push north. And then it seems that naturally these animals huddle together in the winter to keep warm, and they end up huddling with the wrong species, essentially.
Yeah.
There's no one else to huddle with, and then they mate. So now there are these hybrid squirrels showing up.
Can they still fly, or they're tree-bound?
No, they're both flying squirrels, so they can
okay.
still fly. And the question, of course, is this a horrible thing, or is this something, this is some way in which the animal itself adapts? You know, in other words, will this hybrid version give rise to a new lineage that's perfectly adapted to the emerging climate in those areas?
What other hybrids are we seeing emerging naturally, if that's the right word, if this is a result of man-made climate change? I don't know if natural is the right word, but what other hybrids are coming out of the woods and fields?
Right, so the one that got the most attention are these polar growler bears, as they're called, or sometimes they're called pizzlies. They're grizzly bear, polar bear hybrids. They're appearing in the Canadian Arctic and the islands. The first one was harvested in 2006, meaning that it was shot by a hunter. And two more have appeared. One second generation has also appeared. And this past year, there have been a number of sightings. This past year, this past spring, they captured another female that looked like a hybrid with grizzly-looking cubs. And what's no one really knows is sort of the relative contribution of different factors in the emergence of these animals, but obviously climate is one factor. The Arctic is warming between 2 and 4 times faster than the rest of the world. But the other factor is just better management of hunting generally, allowing this sort of phalanx of bachelor male grizzlies moving north. So the grizzly bears naturally leave where they're born. If they're male, they wander away to find mates. So there's a sort of wave of grizzlies pushing into polar bear territory, and the climate change is perhaps making it a little bit more friendly for them there. I mean, who knows? Maybe the climate change is not playing any role. But the other thing that's interesting is that these bears have hybridized in the past before, long before the human footprint, so to speak, became so gigantic. But in those times past, it seems to have correlated also with natural climate change. So it may be something that happens periodically when the climate changes and the animals are pushed together.
Have they had enough time to study yet? You've got a photograph here of a caramel-colored grizzly polar hybrid cub. Do they grow up to have a polar bear temperament or a grizzly bear temperament? They can be rather different.
Yeah, they're very, and actually, you know, speaking with the scientists, it's the grizzlies that they're smaller, but they're the ones that are more aggressive. The Inuit who live up there, who aren't necessarily used to seeing a lot of grizzlies, they really dislike them, apparently, because they're just extremely aggressive. You know, the scientists were telling me that they can jump up and swat at helicopters. They're, you know, when the scientists are trying to sort of follow and track them, they'll actually try to, you know, take the helicopter down. They can if they're
alive. I worked up in northern Alaska in the Arctic there. I mean, they would take the door right off of a freezer trailer if there were ice cream inside.
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of remarkable animals. Both animals are remarkable, clearly, for slightly different reasons. But in terms of temperament, they seem to, it's unclear. I mean, the question is, if ice, you know, sea ice is declining. So it's making it very difficult for polar bears in some mm-hmm. areas to hunt seals, which is what they do from sea ice. That's what they're specialized in. So would a hybrid bear be perfectly adapted to a situation in which there's less sea ice throughout the year, and you need to sort of be more omnivorous like a grizzly. A grizzly basically eats anything.
But what do we know about how instinct is passed on in a hybrid? I mean, a polar bear knows how to hunt for seal. Does a grizzly polar hybrid know how to hunt for seal?
Well, one of the scientists told me, actually, that one of the hybrids, they looked at its hair to see, they analyzed its hair to see what its diet consisted of. And since its mother was a polar bear, and its mother, the mother is the animal that teaches you how to survive, in that case, it seemed like it had a very marine mammal-intensive diet.
Wow.
But as the generations progress, they seem to mate with grizzlies so that the polar bear blood gets diluted over time. They don't mate the other way, it seems like, at least so far. So that over time, the percentage of polar bear genes that these animals carry declines. So they become more and more grizzly-like. So,
what are scientists projecting? If climate change continues, what other hybrids might we see as this maybe moves south, or maybe it goes on all over the place? There's change at every latitude.
Yeah, well, I mean, I should point out that it's not just climate change. I mean, the way we affect habitats some of your guests were pointing out, mm-hmm. there's many sort of pressures that we put on the natural world. And the coy wolf, which is the other example, that has nothing to do with climate change. That results solely from, you know, past farming stretching from colonial times to now, and hunting. So
this coyote and wolf hybrid.
That's right, coyote and wolf hybrid, which it seems to have been born above the Great Lakes somewhere and then colonized in within a century most of the Northeast, all the way down to Virginia, really, and probably to North Carolina.
Do they act more like wolves or more like coyotes?
Well, they're about genetically about a quarter wolf, and they seem to have enough of the wolf-like sort of heft and strength in their jaws, in particular, to hunt the eastern deer, which are there are many deer in the eastern forests, mm-hmm. to the degree that they're considered a pest often. But they also are very wily, like coyotes. Like, wolves don't do very well in humanized landscapes,
mm-hmm.
Partly because we pursue them and get rid of them, but also partly because, a wolf is a very social animal, and if you sort of take out some of the dominant individuals in the pack, the whole pack can sort of suffer and even die, or like they'll go off and join other packs. Very social. Coyotes, much less so. They're also somewhat social, but they're much less dependent on the sort of hierarchy. At least this is according to what some of the scientists told me.
Moises, we could talk all day on this, but we're out of time. You raised the curtain on a really interesting picture, wily hybrids and more. Moises Velasquez-Manoff wrote about it for the New York Times. Thank you, Moises. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.